Yeah, there's always the question of are some major league teams playing checkers while everyone else is playing chess, and then the Rockies are over there playing Scrabble.
Us November and the waning sun, and all the proofs I like to prove, we go down tonight.
Welcome to episode 111 of Flags Fly Forever, a Baseball Prospectus podcast. I'm your host, George Bissell. I'm a writer at Baseball Prospectus, and tonight I'm joined by a returning guest. His name is Alex Chamberlain. He's a writer at Rotographs and Rotoballer. Alex, what's going on, buddy? It's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me back. Nothing's going on. I just spent like 15 minutes trying to troubleshoot Skype, but you know, it's all good.
So you're in Hawaii now, I understand.
I am in Hawaii, yeah.
What brings you there? Work?
No, actually my fiance is originally from Hawaii.
That's
awesome. So I've got an excuse. But yeah, I also work remotely from here. My office is still in Portland, so
not a bad deal at all, if I do say so.
It could be worse. Yeah.
I understand you're our newly converted DRA disciple as well.
Yeah, well, so I admit that I don't do as much reading in terms of baseball as I'd like to, and so I think I've fallen behind a little bit, and I'm just not well versed in things, and I would like to be, but I see the DRA thing all the time. I'm like, oh yeah, whatever, like it's probably pretty good, but like, yeah, I don't know what it's about. So I'm converted, but I'm also still poorly versed in the subject, so let's just call me a blind follower for now.
I want to start off with a quote, and I want to get your impression of what it means, because I've been reading a lot lately. Actually, ironically, the opposite of you, apparently. I've been reading, I read a book this summer. It's by Chuck Klosterman. It's his newest one. I read it in the summer, and then I had a bunch of article ideas, and then I just never got around to writing them. And this is the time of the year when I read stuff and I get inspired. So there's a great quote that he has. It's not a quote. It's something from one of the chapters. And he says, "What we currently consider to be true, both objectively and subjectively, is habitually provisional. But the modern problem is that reevaluating what we consider true is becoming increasingly difficult. Superficially, it's becoming easier for any one person to dispute the status quo." Pretty deep.
Yeah, I'm still processing it. Are you talking about it like specifically in terms of baseball too?
I'm talking about just everything in general right now.
Literally just the world.
The title of the book is "But What If We're Wrong?" And it tries to evaluate how the future's going to look. So how will the future view the present? And basically his conclusion is that information's so widespread that we no longer have a grasp on what the objective truth actually is anymore.
I think there's validity to that. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, now that I've alienated all of our listeners, we're going to talk about the winter
meetings. They all turned it off already. Yeah.
Yeah. What a terrible start to this podcast. Maybe I should just do the whole thing over again. That might be easier. All right. So we're going to talk about the winter meetings. This is the Hot Stove Edition recap. There's been like 50 trades and signings that have gone down this week. So I thought, what better way to do this than to have Alex on? And we'll talk about all of them in one shot. So I want to start off with the Chris Sale deal. Chicago White Sox trading Chris Sale to Boston for Yoan Moncada, Michael Kopech, and a couple other lesser prospects. But this one has some pretty major fantasy implications, and I guess I'll start with Chris Sale. His strikeouts were down a little bit last year, but a career high in innings. For me, I think the improvement in some of the contextual factors really make him the number one starter in the American League this next year. Do you agree with that assessment?
It's going to be close. I guess what he's up against, Kluber, basically. Who else?
Verlander, and then the other two guys in his rotation, fantasy wise.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, I think you can make that argument. I think you could have probably already made that argument, except Chris Sale is the perennial 12-win pitcher, except for last year. So he's always kind of lagged in the category that should probably no longer count for anything. The strikeouts, I guess I'm a little concerned. I honestly haven't looked too deeply into it, but I'm willing to chalk it up to a blip on the radar because it's not wildly different than it's been in the past. And I'm looking at his peripherals now, and there's nothing really too alarming that stands out. So I would bank on, a bounce back at least a little bit, but still basically with like a 5 strikeout to walk ratio. I mean, that'll do.
Yeah, my baseball prospectus colleague Wilson Karaman, he had a couple interesting notes in the write up that's up there on the site now. Basically, Sale won 17 games last year, but he had 9 quality starts in which he didn't record a win, which is pretty nuts. And last year, well, his two catchers were terrible. Deonner Navarro and Alex Avila, they cost an average of 12 runs due to framing last year. For the season,
right?
So
right.
They sucked. So that might explain the strikeout rate being down a little bit. So sure, Boston's not that much better. I mean, Christian Vasquez, if he were to catch every day, he might be talking something there. But even just a marginal upgrade maybe improves the strikeouts a little bit in theory. And Boston, they scored the most runs in the majors last year. So they've taken a step back, obviously, a little bit offensively. I don't think with Ortiz gone, but they're still going to be a very good offense. So I'm a little bit optimistic about Chris Sale after this deal. I think this is a good thing for his fantasy value. It's not that much of an extreme difference going from the Cell to, or wherever the White Sox play now. I can't remember. Is it still the Cell? Do I have to look this up?
Is it Guaranteed Rate?
Oh, geez. Is that what it's called?
I think so.
That's
or am
terrible.
I thinking of a, I that think says, of a different, I don't remember now.
No, it says U.S. Cellular. I just looked it up. U.S. Cellular Field.
Well, then what is the guaranteed rate thing? I swear, U.S. Cellular changing it to guaranteed rate. I wonder if that's next year.
So
okay.
I'm still technically correct, although I'm incorrect in the future. Hey, it all ties back to the Chuck Klosterman quote again.
Right.
whatever you believe is whatever you believe, and that's the truth.
Yeah. Well,
I did it.
Right, yeah. I think Sale to the Sox is definitely a boon to his value. And I, when you said his rotation mates, I had to think for a second. I don't think Price and Porcello even really hold a candle to Sale. And I know Price had his glory days, and he's still a really good starter. But I think he's kind of, I mean, again, these are things that I look more in depth, like probably in February. So now I'm just kind of like talking out of my ass, but in terms of like his strikeout efficacy and like his walk rate, I mean, these are things that are slowly degrading. They're still like pretty much elite, basically right in line with Sale. But I think I've, for whatever reason, I've always thought of Sale as the superior pitcher between the two in the last 5 years. Whether that's actually true or not. So maybe this is just a bias on my part.
No, that's absolutely true. And for the record, I over-prepare for everything. So I have a million stats and numbers in front of me, and I'm like a crazy person. But Rick Porcello, I think because of the 22 wins last year, he earned in mixed leagues by Mike Gianella's valuations. He does all the valuation stuff for us. And Porcello was a $31 pitcher in 15-team standard mixed, and Sale was 29. So, but if you regress the wins back to 15 or so, Porcello doesn't come close. So,
right, right.
You're right. David Price, where was he? I feel he was up there. Man,
he was
David
probably
Price didn't have a good year. The volume
he didn't
was good.
Of the, right, right. The volume was good. The home run rate is what killed him. And that's, that's probably something that comes back to earth. Especially in light of, well, okay, so here's the thing. I mean, we had the power surge last year, and I don't have a damn clue what to make of that. And I don't know
I wrote a big guys, column about this.
Did you? I don't have any idea like what to do with the pitchers who suffered a home run spike against them that coincided with the league-wide home run spike. So I'm kind of like at a loss in that regard. I'm willing to just accept that it's going to regress back to kind of like a league average or a price average value, but it's just kind of flummoxing.
Well, there are some pitchers like Max Scherzer. I mean, he gives up a lot of solo home runs, but that's kind of by design almost because he's just putting the ball over the plate when there's nobody on base. So, you know, there are some guys I'm not as concerned about. And to tie it all back into Chris Sale, I mean, Sale had a 2.69 DRA last year. So he was even better than his ERA would suggest. So Sale's as good as it gets, and I think the trade's only going to help him out a little bit. The interesting element to this deal on the other side is Yoan Moncada, because I think this is great for his long-term value. I don't think he makes a huge impact in 2017, because I think he could actually benefit from half a season in the minor leagues. I think that would be probably the best thing, but he's going to be the centerpiece of the White Sox lineup, and he gets to move back to second base. So are you as excited and optimistic about Moncada now? Because I think this just kind of solidifies his value and increases the likelihood that he reaches that ceiling we all kind of are hoping and projecting, that, you know, he's a 280 hitter with 20 home runs and 30 steals a year. I think it's more realistic now than it was a week ago.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I definitely agree. I've been kind of curious, I guess might be the word, as to how and why Red Sox promote players the way they do. And I think they've been really premature with a lot of their prospects, kind of unnecessarily, given how kind of elite they were performing at such an elite level last year, and yet they still called up Benintendi basically just to bench him, and they called up Moncada just to bench him. And I think, while I think the former is actually more major league ready than Moncada, I think, you know, maybe Benintendi was ready, but I don't think Moncada is anywhere near ready. I would really like to see him cut down on the strikeouts, because right now he's just free swinging. And I, you know, with them in quote unquote rebuild mode, there's really no harm in sending him back down and, you know, getting some more seasoning for him.
Yeah, the interesting thing is the speed for me with Moncada, because not a lot of guys are stealing bases anymore. I've been doing the landscape pieces at Baseball Prospectus, you know, going back to the home run surge, and, you know, the opposite trend is kind of apparent in steals, where they're just declining, and the guys at the top, you know, your Billy Hamiltons of the world, Jonathan Villar was a good example last year, you know, guys who can steal, even like Paul Goldschmidt, like his value, you know, was insanely high because of the, I think he had 35 steals, but only about 11 guys stole more than 30 bases last year. So it's becoming rare, and Moncada's a guy who can do that. And if he's also going to hit in the middle of the lineup and hit for power and average, you're talking about one of the, you know, best players in fantasy baseball potentially. So that's why we get so excited, and that's why we talk about Yoan Moncada. So there's a lot of talent there. The other big deal involving the White Sox was Adam Eaton going to the Washington Nationals for Lucas Giolito and Ronaldo Lopez. Those were the two big names. Lopez is more of a reliever than anything, but Giolito's interesting. And, you know, what are your impressions of Adam Eaton going to Washington? Because I think this one is actually really interesting fantasy-wise.
Yeah, I haven't thought too critically about it, other than I think it's just a general plus for him. I mean, on top, you know, the same way that Red Sox will help Sale, the Nationals are just a better lineup than the White Sox were. And for the Nats, this is kind of steering away from Eaton, but I mean, upgrading over, I guess it would be Michael Taylor. You know, that's probably like a 4-WAR upgrade right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like it might be like closer to a 10, but
right. Yeah, I don't know. Was he negative WAR? He might have been.
It might be.
Yeah, and I don't think Eaton's going to perform significantly differently, but we're going to probably see, I don't know, like a 10 to possibly like a 10 or 15 run and RBI bump just being in a better lineup. You know, I don't know what the arithmetic is behind that, and it's probably not, it might not be quite as scaled up as that, but Yeah, I mean, it should only be good things for him. It should be only good things.
You know what's interesting about this trade? It has nothing to do with fantasy baseball, actually. Eaton was, fielding runs above average last year, he was 29 fielding runs above average in right field for the White Sox, which is, like, insane. I think only Mookie Betts was better in right. But the year before in center field, he was only 2.1. So he's, like, not a great center fielder, apparently, the metrics-wise, but he's one of, like, the best right fielders in baseball.
So sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. No. I think, and I'd have to look up this, I think Jeff Sullivan at Fangraphs reviewed this at some point because Eaton was on an absurd pace.
Yeah.
Given Adam Eaton, I'm trying to type and talk and I can't do that because I cannot multitask.
Yeah.
His fielding metrics, right? And he did one of those things where he like reviewed every assist or something like that. And he was like generally I guess it was good, but it also seemed like the defensive metrics were overrating him because he had like 8 or 9 assists and like a couple of them were like complete gimmies. And they just like weren't as impressive to the eye as they might have been on paper. So we might be overrating his abilities in right field. I don't deny that he might be better in right field, but the disparity between 2015 and 2016 is probably not as great as we think it is.
Well, hey, Alex, I guess I have some news for you. What we consider to be true, both objectively and subjectively, is habitually provisional.
No.
That's the last time I'm going to say that. probably not. But no, it allows Trey Turner to move back to shortstop, which I think is the most interesting part of this deal, because what's funny is shortstop is loaded right now. I don't know if long term that's like great for Turner. It seemed like he'd be more valuable in the outfield right now, given the state of everything. Is that
right?
Is that weird to say? Because I feel like it is, but it's kind of true.
It's I guess outfield's thinning out a little bit with like the decline of McCutchen, depending on your I guess perception of him, and I guess with like Jose Bautista. You're kind of right. I mean, I feel like outfield just runs deep. It just feels weird to have such a deep infield.
Yeah.
Between second base and shortstop. Like we're so used to like thinking that a 10 home run, 10 stolen base season from what's his face, Pedroia, is mm-hmm. good. And now we're spoiled with guys who do like 25-25. So ironically, Trey's kind of in like the wrong era. He came like 5 years too late because he would be a juggernaut if this was like 2012. He's still a juggernaut, he could be a juggernaut, but he's just not. Yeah, it just doesn't seem as special when VR might do the exact same thing.
We're gonna have to have the definitive what to do about home runs and middle infield podcast at some point, because I've run into this problem just doing early projections, because I look at it and I go, well, how can I project Brad Miller to do what he did last year, like or come anywhere close to that? Didi Gregorius, like, is this really gonna happen again, or should I like, how do you even hedge that? It's really difficult. That's the biggest thing I found. But speaking of guys who hit 10 home runs and 10 steals, that's what basically Adam Eaton did last year. He hit 14 home runs, 14 steals. He's never stolen more than 18. So he was outfielder number 18 in standard mixed leagues last year. So he's a top 20 outfielder. And like you said, Alex, I think if you bump up the runs a little bit, he could score 100 runs. And in that lineup, with the especially, I think with the, he has like a 362 on base percentage. So if he's leading off in that lineup, he's going to score a ton of runs in front of the heart of that order. So lots to like there with Eaton overall. I think he's pretty safe in that top 15 to 20 range of outfielders. So do you have any thoughts on Lucas Giolito? Because I have many.
Yeah. Sure. You know, I mean, I guess this was like the big deal on Twitter, from what I could tell. Obviously, people think they think the Nats paid way too much for Eaton. And I think, and again, this is just my perception, at least of the fantasy baseball world. But I think fantasy owners get caught up on, you know, number one overall picks or first round picks or top prospect tags, and they cling to those a lot longer than a team, an actual team, might cling to them. And I think, you know, I think the Nationals are seeing probably what everyone else is seeing, but also just being more realistic about Giolito's, not maybe not his ceiling, but the probability of him reaching his ceiling. Mm-hmm. Especially with not, you know, not really anything special in terms of strikeouts and walks so far. And not like it's been a long time, but you'd think that someone of his caliber, allegedly, would have a better double A season at 22 than he did this year. And so I also think, you know, with the Nationals, their window to contend is probably closing pretty rapidly if they don't have any intention of trying to lock up Bryce Harper. So I think they're just being realistic about their present needs versus the future value of Giolito, which to them is declining. And Eaton, who's probably, he was a 6 WAR player last year, which actually blows my mind. I had no idea. That's with the defense, though.
Yes.
But still, like a 4 WAR player. So they're getting ample present value in exchange for what is actually a lot more risk than people are chalking it up to be. And so they're just basically unloading risk for a bona fide star player right now. So I think it's a perfectly defensible move. I can just understand why National fans are upset.
It's certainly justifiable. I think the interesting thing with Giolito is, at Baseball Prospectus, we put out our top 10 prospects list for the Nationals. And I don't know if, for Fangraphs, if Eric Longenhagen has done the Nationals list yet. Or, well, now the White Sox list. I guess, however you want to slice it. But for some context, we put out our top 10 list, and Jeff Paternostro and the prospect team. And they had Victor Robles as the number one prospect for the Nationals this offseason, which turned out to kind of be the case in this trade discussion, because they wouldn't offer Robles in a deal for Eaton, but they would have for Sale. So I think the problems I have with Giolito were the mechanics. He dealt with some of those issues last year, and you know, they said that he corrected them late in the year, but I don't know. The velocity was down. He was only throwing about 93, I believe, without looking at Brooks baseball right in front of me. And his control was not good either. So those are three pretty substantial variables. And sure, I mean, in the past, he's had insane, like 80 grades on his fastball, but it's not there anymore. And, you know, if you're the White Sox, this is the perfect kind of guy to gamble on. Because if he puts it all together, you're looking at a front of the rotation guy. And this is exactly what you want to do if you're not contending. But, you know, I think he's a long way off from helping fantasy owners. And right now, he's a guy who I really struggle to place in dynasty rankings. And I have no idea what to do with him. If you own him already, I think you're kind of stuck with him, so to speak. I don't think you can sell him. But he's certainly not a guy I'm going out and trying to get and putting all my eggs in that type of a basket. Because the profile is just really, really risky at this point. So, let's see. The other big ones. We're going to get to most of these winter meetings deals over the last couple of days. There have been so many. This feels like one of the best off seasons in a while, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I've actually really enjoyed it. Usually I don't really care, but I feel like for some reason it's been really compelling this year.
I had the Rule 5 on this morning, and I got to say, I was just fired up. It was great. When the Red Sox picked Josh Rutledge, I almost fell out of my chair laughing. It was amazing. Because they just DFA'd him like a month ago.
Oh, I forgot he was on the... You see, I have always treated Josh Rutledge as a Rocky, like basically the entire time. I know he probably hasn't been a Rocky for like 2 or 3 years, and I always think he's a Rocky.
You want to hear something ironic? He was in the Brewers system, and their minor league affiliate in AAA is located in Colorado Springs, where he was assigned.
I didn't even know he was a Brewer. Yeah. I had no idea.
Neither did I, but now he is a Red Sox once again. Dave Dombrowski doing stuff. Speaking of good deals, the Cubs, man, they picked up Wade Davis for Jorge Soler. And correct me if I'm wrong here, Jorge Soler is not good. Is that a fair statement? I don't see it.
Those are a lot of swing and miss words. Yeah. I think, I think it depends on who you're talking to. I was huge on Jorge probably, it was probably, 2 years ago at this point, when he just had like a monster. I guess it was only like a fourth of a season probably in like double A. Like I was probably unreasonably excited, just as everyone else was. But he's a swing and miss guy. You know, I think he actually took some nice steps last year. I mean, he bumped up the walk rate, he struck out less. He just kind of had a tough time with I think it was with the BABIP, the batting average on the balls in play, and just batting average in general. And I don't know if there's legitimacy to that. I didn't really look at the peripherals. I know he didn't really have a stellar line drive rate after having an incredible line drive rate the year before. So I just, I think there's some upside there. I think he could develop. I mean, he posted almost a 200 ISO. So I think he could be a step away from turning the corner. But I also just don't even know what to make of his profile at this point. I don't know what kind of hitter he is anymore.
Yeah, exactly. He didn't play a lot either. He only had 264 plate appearances last year, had 12 home runs. So he does hit for power. The batting average, not great. I think he was around 238 last year.
Yeah,
so 240 to 250 is, it's fine. It's passable. But I wonder what a full season looks like. And apparently that's what the Royals are going to do. They're going to put him out there and they're going to let him play every day, which is fine and all. But where do you put the ceiling if you're projecting that kind of playing time in? Where would you tentatively like have him ranked? Because I don't know if he cracks my top 50 outfielders, even with everyday at bats. I don't know.
I mean,
just off the top of my head, I can't see myself doing it.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know where like the top 50 cutoff might be, but I would give him like 20 home runs and a 260 average. Maybe not quite as a ceiling. But I mean, if they're going to give him 600 plate appearances, I would say 20 and 260, and that's probably like a low, that's like a middling outfielder, because that's pretty ordinary at this point.
Just in the game in general, going back to the power, 110 guys hit 20 home runs last year. So that doesn't, him hitting 20 home runs just isn't worth what it was a couple years ago, if that makes sense, even, right? So
right.
He's not adding any speed. Is he going to hit at the top of the Royals lineup? And I don't know. I don't get like too excited over Jorge Soler, and I feel bad about that because I feel like we should get excited about him. He's fun, but I don't know. Wade Davis to me is interesting. What are your impressions of him? Because I think the injuries now, he's 31 years old, and he was out about 50 days on the disabled list with a strained flexor in his right forearm, which sounds terrifying as hell. he just wasn't that great. 3.73 deserve run average in 43 innings, 10 strikeouts per nine. The walk rate was up. He was about 3 walks per nine, which is his worst since, 2012. Interestingly enough, he didn't give up a home run in 43 innings, but it just felt to me like his command was off all year, and then he was hurt, and I don't know if he's someone you can bank on as, I don't think he's in the same class as, Zach Britton and those types of closers anymore. Kenley Jansen, Chapman, Melanson, who we'll talk about later. I don't think he's in that class anymore for me, just because I'm so concerned about the health risk. I don't think I could project 60, 70 innings. Is that fair?
Yeah, no, I think it's fair. I don't think I would put him in the top five. Britton, Jansen, Chapman, all above him easily. Health is a concern. I'm not overly concerned about the walk rate yet. I mean, I do not like a 3.3 walks per nine from a closer, really. But I subscribe heavily to kind of a freehand look at swinging strike rate as a gauge for strikeouts. And his 13.1% last year, even, just in 40 innings, was the second best of his career. And at a certain point, you got to chalk it up to sequencing a little bit. I think the strikeouts are going to bounce back as long as he's healthy. And I think he could still, limit contact and, prevent hard contact at a rate that few can match. But the durability is an issue. And, right, I don't know. I just don't think he's as elite as we might expect him to be. I don't think he's going to be at his 2015 level or his 2014 level by any means.
No, I think there's a great trade in from a baseball standpoint by the Cubs. I mean, they get an established guy who can, you know, if they get, they're going to get back to the playoffs. This is a guy you can hand the ball to in the ninth and feel confident that he's going to come through for you. So I understand it completely, but I just think there are some bigger medical red flags than I think any of us really want to admit here with Davis. I'm really concerned. I just I can't see myself paying for what I think he'll go for in drafts. So, we're talking to Alex Chamberlain. He's a writer for Rotographs, part of the Fangraphs network. You're still with Rotoballer, correct? Rotoballer as well.
Yeah, I'm not. I haven't been writing this off season, but I plan to rejoin back in, you know, March.
Sounds good. Awesome. And you can follow him on Twitter at Dolph Haldhagen, which I say correctly every time.
Yes, you do.
Awesome. So let's talk about some of the free agent signings, with apologies to Tyler Thornburg, who is awesome and all, but, like, not a lot of fantasy impact there. Unless you think the Milwaukee side of the thing is interesting with Travis Shaw and guys like that. Any takeaways from that, or do you want to move on?
We can move on. I just think I think what Milwaukee's been doing the last year and a half in free agency, Rule 5, in trades, I think they're doing a really interesting rebuild. I'm pretty intrigued. I'm not super big on Shaw, but, I mean, you know, Thornburg's not going to do you a whole lot of good. So might as well take a chance on a guy who has shown some, like, pretty, you know, he showed some pretty good tools at one point, and maybe they can help him refine his swing or his approach or whatever. Do the things that you need to do to extract some value from him.
Let's talk about some of the other big free agent signings. I think we'll breeze through the closers here. Aroldis Chapman re-signed with the New York Yankees. He of the $86 million contract. He was the fifth best relief pitcher last year. Bad news for Dellin Betances. And then Mark Melancon got 4 years and $62 million from the Giants. He was the, fourth best relief pitcher last year in 15-team mixed leagues, earning about $22. He'll be 32 on opening day, but it's been really good. Anything on these two signings? Because I just expect more of the same, or what do you think?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to go into it too much. I feel bad for Dellin Betances because that dude is a boss. And I really like watching him pitch. I like watching him pitch in the ninth, but I think I also kind of enjoy knowing that I could have him throw 90 innings again in a year, and just pile up strikeouts in good ratios. So
yeah.
It's all right. It's not the end of the world. Chapman and Melancon, people freaked out about. I think he's probably one of the safer bets, even though he's not like a totally elite option. I think he's going to age like fairly gracefully for a closer, especially at AT&T Park. I think he's going to do just fine. So,
yeah, he had 47 saves a year ago, 2.91 DRA. Chapman's numbers are crazy. 2.04 deserve run average, 14 strikeouts per nine. He only had 36 saves and he was still a top five closer. So yeah, that's scary. He's really good at closing. So, yeah, that's all I got. The most interesting free agent signing to me was Ian Desmond. He got 5 years and $70 million from the Colorado Rockies, and they're gonna play him at they're gonna play him at first base. So, you know, this is Ian Desmond's a great example of fun with half season slash lines. I think, you know, the overall season line looks good. You know, 285, 22 home runs, 21 steals. But in the first half of the year, he hit 317 with a 371 on base, 525 slugging. In the second half, he hit 251 with a 296 on base and 363 slugging. And basically his numbers cratered in August and September. He was just terrible those 2 months. I'm not optimistic about Ian Desmond.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird situation because it looked like he bounced back from his bad 2015, and now it kind of looks like maybe the it's hard to know if the 2015 was the outlier or if the first half of 2016 is the outlier. Kind of like with Justin. I actually was just looking at Justin Upton yesterday with his just atrocious first half, but he kind of just pulled it all together for the last 4 months. I think, but Ian Desmond's kind of the opposite. I think he's, I think he could be legitimately trending in the wrong direction still. And I just don't know what to make of that. I don't like the move. I keep hearing, I've heard some chatter that they're going to look, they being the Rockies, are going to look toward trading Charlie Blackmon for pitching or trading Carlos Gonzalez and maybe moving Desmond back to the outfield. But I think regardless of how he's being used, I just don't know if 5 years was an appropriate appropriate length. $70 million was an appropriate amount, especially with the other talent that's in free agency. So it just, I think it was just questionable all the way around.
Yeah, there's always the question of are some major league teams playing checkers while everyone else is playing chess, and then the Rockies are over there playing Scrabble. But you know, Desmond's interesting because I wonder how long he keeps the outfield eligibility. I think that's the key variable to his overall profile, because his value was exceptional last year in part because of that eligibility. So I wonder what the transition to first base does if he doesn't get any additional eligibility. Your point you made about just the general trend in his profile, I think, is the one that I subscribe to, where he's 31 now and he's had a 50% ground ball rate in three straight years. So he's not a guy who's going to really benefit from, unless he dramatically overhauls his batted ball profile, he's not going to all of a sudden hit a bunch more home runs. I don't see that happening. His contact rate from 2012 to 2015 dropped 10% from 78% to 68% before it went back up last year. And then how long is he going to continue to steal bases? At 31, he was always a guy who kind of had, you know, decent speed. He was, you know, 20 steals a year, but is he going to continue to do that? So I just think there's so many risks when I look at the immediate future for Ian Desmond that, like, I'm not one of those people who's going to be optimistic that he bounced back and this is what we can expect going forward and Coors is great for him. I can't get that optimistic. It's just not a great profile. It's trending in the wrong direction.
Yeah, I would agree. Although this doesn't really help in a real baseball sense, but I'm thinking about the fact that if he's a 15-15 250 guy, which he might very well be next year, those steals are what's going to keep him afloat, especially at first base, and only at first base. I mean, if he was an outfielder, he'd be much more valuable. But at first base, if he doesn't have that outfield eligibility, you're basically begging for him to keep stealing 20 bases a year. It's good that it's not actually tapering off, really. I mean, it did in 2015, but now that he's brought it back up to, you know, the 20-21 levels, the third time he stole 21 bases, I think you can maybe count on at least a couple more years of it. But I mean, we saw it with Andrew McCutchen. It'll taper off considerably in basically no time. So I think once we see the red flag, we'll know. I think we'll know when the decline is setting in. But until then, we kind of just have to, like, you're either risk averse or you're going to take the risk and assume that he'll just kind of keep cruising at this same stolen base pace.
Yeah, I understand the arguments for Desmond, and I totally get it, but I'm not optimistic about speed. Just doesn't age well, and how long can you expect him to keep doing this as he gets into his mid-30s?
I think
maybe my concern's more from a long-term and a dynasty standpoint, that I just see him declining across the board here, and you never want to be a year late on a guy like that, because you're not going to get any sort of return. You have to, if the bottom falls out completely or he starts to get hurt, you're really going to be in trouble. So I'm not as optimistic about Ian Desmond as, you know, if you were 5 years younger, yeah, absolutely great. But I don't see it. Interesting things, anything else on Desmond? Or
no, I guess you have a good point. I would just say that if you're in a dynasty, I mean, your best time to sell is right now. because he's not going to be any more valuable than he is right now. So
you're going to find someone who believes in the rebound and believes in the Coors factor. I just like I said with the ground ball rate. I mean, you know, he could hit 20. Is he going to hit 20 home runs? Sure, he's going to do that probably. But you know, he's not a guy who's going to all of a sudden accelerate into the 30s and 40s. You know, unless he really starts hitting more fly balls, and that's hard to do. It's really hard to change your batted ball profile. It really is not that easy. Matt Holliday, Rich Hill. Matt Holliday, I mean, is there anything here? I mean, his BABIP was like, you want to talk about something crazy. It was like 250. It was like disgustingly low because he hit no line drives and he's old. So
yeah,
I don't
see
a whole lot here, but someone will draft him in your league.
He still makes good contact. I mean, despite the line drive rate, I think 250 might be a bit low, but I think we're looking at a guy. Well, actually, he had like a 30 home run pace too. But again, we're talking about the power surge of 2016. But yeah, I mean, like 18 home runs, 260. Again, we're talking about Jorge Soler territory, which is a back end outfielder at best. Probably he's not going to hit 300 anymore. I think those days are long gone.
Rich Hill. Rich Hill to me is interesting because he is a DRA darling if I've ever seen one. I feel like at Baseball Prospectus, we've been obsessed with this guy. I know on the Effectively Wild podcast, they've been talking about him for 2 years now. But Rich Hill, he had 110 innings last year. He had a 2.58 DRA. His actual ERA was 2.12, which is insane. He was... Among starters with 100 innings pitched, he was 6th in DRA. He was also top 10 in strikeout rate. Pay for those 100 innings, I think, is the estimate. How are you projecting Rich Hill for 2016 from an innings standpoint?
So I don't have any idea how blisters fare in terms of like a long-term prognosis. Like you get concerned about like hamstrings, you get concerned about shoulders, but he missed like 2 months because of a blister. So I'm typically a risk averse person. I'm not really concerned at all. I mean, he's old. Granted, he's old, but his quote unquote injury plagued season was a damn blister that whole time. So I would project him for like 140, which is possibly conservative. And even 140 innings of like a 3 ERA or whatever he's going to end up doing, is going to be awesome, because I think from what I've seen in these industry mock drafts and these actual drafts that have cropped up prior to 2017, actually, you know, turning the calendar page, he's not going that high. He went like 40. He might have gone like 50th in a mock draft I was in.
That's stupid low. No.
So he's like, he's not getting the respect, and it's because of age. It's because of a quote unquote like lack of track record. It's because of the quote unquote injury concerns. But I think, you know, if he's gonna fall anywhere lower than like 30th, you have to take a chance on him, and you can just Frankenstein a pitcher out of the missing innings. Like, you can easily find or stream your way to a quality Frankenstein pitcher using 140 of Rich Hill's innings. Like, that is something that I'm very interested in doing in 2017 if people are not going to respect him.
See, this is crazy, because I thought that we had gotten to the point with Rich Hill where enough people knew how good he was that he was actually going to be overpaid and that people were going to be more aggressive than they should on him. And based on what you just said, that's not the case right now in some drafts. I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me, because I think we have enough evidence here. In the last, since August of 2015, I think we have enough evidence that when Rich Hill pitches, he's going to limit runs, and he's going to strike people out. I think that's the only issue, is how many innings you're going to project him. I'd pay for 110, 120, whatever that comes out to from a valuation standpoint. But that's crazy to me that people don't want to invest in him. That seems really crazy to me, and not numbers-based strategy at all. Is that a fair statement? Because that just seems nuts to me.
No, it is fair. I'm looking, so I'm looking, I've seen only a few draft boards, but Tristan Cockcroft posted a couple. There's one here, he went in the 12th round of a 15-team draft. He went after, God, this is crazy.
This is an industry one?
This is an industry draft that took place at First Pitch, Arizona, in November. He went after Garrett Cole, which, you know, you can make an argument either way about him, but he went after Michael Fulmer. He went after Julio Teheran. He went after Jose Quintana. He went after John Lackey. He went after Felix, after Jeff Samardzija.
I wouldn't take Felix Hernandez over. I would not take after Felix Marcus Hernandez.
Matt Moore?
I wouldn't take Stroman over.
Take Matt Moore over him?
No, because of the volatility. Matt Moore's weird. I wouldn't take him over Rich Hill. No.
Right.
I wouldn't take Stroman, Hill, or Hernandez. Those three. Hernandez. Geez, he's really kind of declined across the board here. So Stroman is interesting because the volume of innings is attractive. I think in a deeper format, you have to strongly think about it because there aren't many guys who throw 200 innings anymore. It was like 15 last year or something like that. So that has some value, but those are some, he's going too late. I think it seems late.
I agree.
All right. There are some other interesting smaller moves like Steve Pearce and Matt Joyce. If you're into platooning, which I am, I'll platoon. I love platooning in non-expert leagues because people think you're crazy. And if it's a head-to-head daily, you just smoke them and it's awesome. Like, it's way fun. Just use like Danny Valencia and like other platoon guys, Andrew Tolles. It's the best thing ever. You should do it. But those guys aren't, huge fantasy guys. So, was there anything else interesting that's happened over the last few days that you, feel like talking about, Alex? Because I've run out of topics now.
Yeah. Real big signing in Arizona. Jeff Mathis, two-year contract.
God damn it.
2 years, $12 million. Yeah, Jeff Mathis is gonna be the big thing, next big thing. He's one of the premier hitters of the last decade. And that's the end of my stupid joke about Jeff Mathis.
Elite
that
framing.
Guy sucks. Yeah. He's obviously a defensive addition, but it was kind of funny to see them. Did they DFA Castillo or just like non-tender him or something?
I don't know off the top of my head. I haven't thought about Wellington Castillo in a while. I'm the functional equivalent of an idiot when it comes to Wellington Castillo knowledge.
whoever their pre-existing catcher was leagues better than Mathis, at least with a bat. Then again, everyone is.
They went with a repeal and potentially replace strategy there.
Correct. Yeah. but maybe I mean maybe he's going to help their turbulent pitching situation.
Turbulent.
Yeah.
That's one way of describing it.
Yeah, it's tumultuous. It's in flux.
In flux.
It is going to be interesting to watch the Diamondbacks this year.
Alex, this has been a lot of fun, and we should absolutely do this again. So tell everybody where they can find your stuff and where they can read your articles and then follow you on Twitter.
All right. You can find me at Rotographs, which is on Fangraphs. Mm. And you can find me at Rotoballer, which will be probably later in the spring when I start writing there again. And you can find me on Twitter at Dolph Haldhagen, which I unfortunately have to spell for you. It's DolphHaulDG. Wait, did I screw this up?
Oh, my
LDG.
God.
Oh, my God. I spelled it wrong. I was talking so slowly. Dolph, I'm not even going to spell it. Dolph Haldhagen. Just do it phonetically or, like, look it up or something. I don't care anymore.
All right. Cool. Alex, thanks so much. We'll do this again in a couple months when you start your draft prep in April.
Okay. Sounds good, dude. Thanks for having me back on.
All right. Hang on the line for a second. But we're going to take a – for the purposes of this podcast, we're going to take a quick break, if I can talk. For a word from our sponsor, Pennant Wars, and then we'll come back. We're going to have another special guest coming on talking about the Red Sox moves and some dynasty prospects. So we'll be right back. Today's episode of Flags Fly Forever is brought to you by Pennant Wars, our presenting sponsor for the podcast. The fantasy baseball regular season may be over, but you can still get your fantasy fix at Pennant Wars. It's an online baseball management game where you call the shots as the GM of your own baseball franchise, build a team that plays your brand of baseball, draft and develop amateurs, spend big in the free agent market, or you can make blockbuster trades. Its in-depth and realistic simulation engine plays out full 162-game seasons. Get your fantasy baseball fix year-round with Pennant Wars. I know the fantasy season is over, but you can still play today at PennantWars.com. Check it out today. Try it for free. That's PennantWars.com. All right, and we're back here on Flags Fly Forever, and I'm joined by my good friend, a Massachusetts native. He's the host of the Red Seat podcast. He's a writer for BP Boston, Jake Devereaux, one of my good friends. Jake, how you doing?
I'm doing well, George. It is awesome to finally be on a show together again. It feels like it's been a while since we've been on here chatting fantasy baseball, so not something I get to do a whole lot of that much these days, and it's nice to get to do it again and be on with you.
Yeah, so can you describe to me the emotional roller coaster of the first 24 hours of the Chris Sale era in Boston?
Oh man, yeah, there's a whole ton of emotions because prospect huggers out there were just over the kind of falling apart because, you know, Dave Dombrowski has traded like 10 of the top 20 prospects in this system over the last 6 months, it seems like. So that was a little upsetting to some people, but I think most people were just completely overjoyed that this rotation now includes two Cy Young winners and a guy who will probably win a Cy Young in the next 3 years in Chris Sale. And the team is now really, really well positioned going into the next 2-3 seasons to do some big things. So while prospects are great, Chris Sale is pretty awesome in his own right. So I was really happy about the trade. I thought it was a fair price and a good get on the Red Sox part.
Yeah, so obviously they picked up Chris Sale for Yoan Moncada, Michael Kopech, the two big pieces to go back. And I think the big question when I look at this trade overall is, do you think that trading Yoan Moncada potentially eliminates the Red Sox chances of extending their window to contend beyond the 2019 season? Because you look at, obviously, anytime you make a trade, you trade a prospect for established major league talent, especially someone as good as Chris Sale, you're going to improve your odds of winning a World Series. So I completely understand it. I agree with the Red Sox for making this trade. 100% makes sense for them. They didn't have to give up any talent on the major league roster to do it. It makes total sense. But I think long term, and this is where I think there is a little bit of validity to the argument that shredding your entire farm system and systematically dealing away at guys, I have less of a problem with it when it's for someone like Chris Sale. But you look at some of the other deals they've made, and I've texted you about these. It feels like we've talked about these a lot in the past, but, you know, like the Drew Pomeranz deal, the Craig Kimbrel deal, some of these minor trades in which they've given up a lot of that depth and valuable pieces that could help them or become part of that future core. You know, I look at, like, 2019 Xander Bogaerts. That'll be his last year before he hits free agency. It's the last year of Chris Sale's contract. Mookie Betts' contract is up in 2020. Who knows whether or not they're going to be able to extend or re-sign any of those three guys. And that's just, you know, some of the key pieces of the core. So I worry because Moncada is one of those potential franchise cornerstone guys. Do you think that there is some validity to that argument that trading all of these prospects maybe does hurt the Red Sox long-term odds of keeping that contention window open?
Yeah, I totally get that argument. I think it's a valid one, but I have to be honest, it's not something that I'm particularly worried about, and there's a few reasons why. First, I'll borrow a page from Dave Dombrowski, and thinking 3-4 years down the road is an eternity in baseball years, so focusing on right now is really the best plan of action. And then the other thing is we don't really know what these guys are going to become. Like Yoan Moncada, he's a highly touted prospect. He's arguably the number one fantasy prospect in baseball right now, but there's still a lot of question marks with him. There's where's he going to play defensively? He hasn't looked particularly great at any of those positions. There's still a lot of swing and miss in his game, some pitch recognition issues, you know, he puts the ball on the ground a lot more than you'd like to see from somebody who has that type of power. There's problems there as well. And then the other thing is, you're looking at an organization in the Red Sox that, you know, say what you want about Bogarts and Betts and Bradley and Benintendi all being up at some point down the road, 2018, 2019, 2020, whatever it is. This organization in the Red Sox is going to lock a lot of these guys up. And it's because they are such a financially strong organization that you can be confident that they're going to do that. So while they might let one or two of these guys get away, I think that they're going to recognize who the core players are. And I would be really shocked if, you know, Bogarts and Betts, for instance, weren't eventually locked up to long-term deals here. And the other thing is, it's not like they're leaving themselves completely barren. Like, with the trade of Yoan Moncada, they still do have Rafael Devers in the system, who does play third base. His defense improved a whole lot last year. So a lot of people think that he'll stick there, at least in the short term. So that provides them an answer there. And then with Kopech, they did just draft Jason Grom, who looks really good in his own right and is probably a more sure thing to stick as a starter. So they can do a good job of rebuilding that system. And I think that the Red Sox organization has shown a really strong ability to scout well, and they'll be able to replenish the organization going forward. So I'm very optimistic, but I definitely do see how this can be an issue. And it can get you into situations where you have to trade for depth pieces, which is definitely not something that you want. And the Red Sox have been really good at developing bench depth, and not so good at developing pitching depth over the last few years.
You know, looking at the long-term future of the Red Sox, and I think that's one of the points you made, it didn't sound like Yoan Moncada really fit in terms of that young nucleus of players, because he was never going to supplant Dustin Pedroia at second base. He wasn't going to be the answer at third, maybe. And that was maybe his best shot, because he wasn't going to go to the outfield. So it feels to me like Moncada really never fit that long-term outlook for the Red Sox, whereas in Chicago, he's now the centerpiece of that lineup and that rebuild, and he's going to get to go back to his natural defensive home at second base. It just feels like this is a good trade for both teams, because Chicago gets that franchise cornerstone they're looking for, and the Red Sox get one of the three or five best pitchers in baseball.
Yeah, I think it's a great trade for both. And then you also see what Rick Hahn did improving with the trade with the Nationals as well, getting those big pieces. You have to be pretty happy if you're a Chicago White Sox fan at this point.
Were you surprised that the Red Sox didn't have to give up any of their existing major league talent to get this deal done? Because that, to me, is what stood out. My understanding was that they were going to have to give up someone potentially on the major league roster. The talk was in the summer, and this is what the White Sox, you know, reports say they were asking for, was guys like Betts and Bogarts and guys like that, Benintendi. They didn't really have to give up anybody like that, even like a Jackie Bradley. There was no major piece that's contributing to the current roster that went into this deal. Was that surprising to you that they were able to get this done without hurting the 2017 lineup or pitching staff?
Yeah, it absolutely was. When I heard that the first two prospects going over were Moncada and Kopech, my first thought was, okay, when is Swihart going to get mentioned? Or when is Eddie Rodriguez going to get mentioned? Because those two guys were logical choices, a young cost-controlled lefty in Eddie Rodriguez with a lot of potential, and then Blake Swihart, who could finally solve the catching woes that Chicago has had for a number of years. It seemed like those guys would have been logical building blocks, and the fact that they weren't included was awesome. I mean, it just made me feel so much better about the deal. But I think it says a little bit more about the direction that Rick Hahn's looking to take with that team. I think that rebuild's probably going to take a little bit more time. It's not going to be really a rebuild on the fly as much as it looks like it's going to be a complete teardown and then kind of starting from scratch again. So it'll be interesting to see if they make any more deals, because they still have some pieces in Robertson that could go, and they still have Abreu that could potentially go. So I don't know. I don't know if that team's actually done. But yeah, I was really shocked that the Red Sox didn't have to give up any of those guys off the major league roster.
Yeah, for the White Sox, Todd Frazier too, I think it makes all the sense in the world to try and deal him and some of those other veterans who aren't going to be around. But that's the weird thing about all the moves they made. They got guys who are, you know, in such close proximity to the majors that it might not take them 5 years to rebuild. It's not like they picked up a bunch of guys who, you know, are 18 years old in single A. So that's the interesting element to the trade to me. Some of the other, you know, things the Red Sox have done here, they picked up Tyler Thornburg. They're going to play Pablo Sandoval at third base. So where do the Red Sox go from here? Because I think the bullpen still is interesting. And Sandoval, I mean, he's looking good. I saw the photos on Twitter the other day. He looks like he had a big story today with a lot of quotes about how, you know, he's been humbled and he's devoted to being a professional, someone who takes care of his body and is committed to winning. It sounds good. What are your impressions of the bullpen, especially with Thornburg now in the mix, and then Pablo Sandoval as the guy at third base, because they don't really have anyone else, it would seem?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the bullpen goes, I think it looks like a potentially really scary unit. You know, if Carson Smith comes back and Joe Kelly can be what he was towards the end of last year, all of a sudden you have Thornburg in the mix, and, you know, if Craig Kimbrell can be healthy and pitch well, you have a unit that looks like it could be one of the better units in the game. Certainly really deep. And I think that right now, as you look at it, when you're trying to piece that bullpen together, it's kind of like, all right, who stays and who goes? Because there are a few guys who performed pretty well at the end of last year, like Heath Hembree, that's out of options. And then Matt Barnes still has an option, but he performed really well for most of last year. So I think it's going to be a really good part of the team. I think it's going to be a huge strength for them. But with the starters, I think that's the area where we could see somebody get moved at this point. And Dombrowski mentioned that today, that potentially one of those guys could become available. And there are reports that the most likely guy to be moved is probably Clay Buchholz, who's owed about $13 million and only has 1 year left. And potentially that could be a move to replenish the system, but I think it could also be for another bat. You know, they kind of do lack a little bit of depth. And you talked about Pablo Sandoval. I mean, the prospect of a team that is going to be contending for the World Series relying on Pablo Sandoval at third base is not the most exciting thing in the world, even though he is in the best shape of his life right now. He does look good, though. I mean, he looks felt, but I'm not going to sit here and tell you that, like, Pablo Sandoval is going to be good. That would be the Red Sox spin machine working a little bit too hard. So I'm cautiously optimistic, but they sure are putting a lot of faith in him now with Shaw gone and with the trade of Yoan Moncada. So it's a little scary, but I think we need a little fear headed into the season.
Yeah, optimism in Boston's never a good thing. It's just more fun when the teams underperform. It's really fun because everybody freaks out, and it's awesome. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Jake Devereaux. He's a writer for VP Boston. He's also the host of the Red Seat podcast, which I highly recommend. If you don't know what the Red Seat is, please Google it. I'm not going to explain it. Please do
needs
that.
No explanation.
Yeah, if you're not a Red Sox fan, I understand. But you know, we're talking about the Red Sox because they've made some of the biggest moves this offseason, and I think they're a really fascinating team. They led the American League or all of the majors in runs last year, so they're very fantasy relevant. So who do you think is maybe the most intriguing fantasy guy on Boston's roster right now? Because obviously, you know, you have Mookie Betts and Xander Bogaerts, and, you know, those guys are great and all, but who's somebody you think is going to step up in a big way that fantasy owners should be projecting to make a big impact for them next year?
Well, if I'm a fantasy owner, I'm not going to hesitate at all at going after Andrew Benintendi to be one of my starters going into next year. The way that the team's currently set up right now, it looks like Benintendi and Bradley are going to get a full slate of at-bats out there. They're not going to get platooned at any point. And when I look at Andrew Benintendi, I really see a guy who has a similar fantasy potential to a guy like Christian Yelich. I think he could do that same type of thing. But maybe with a little bit more pop considering the ballpark. And Yelich's been an incredibly valuable fantasy asset. So I see him as being kind of that type of player. With Pablo Sandoval, hey, I know we don't want to bank on him, but he's going to cost you pretty much nothing this year. And if he is in the best shape of his life, and if he does come back and do some things, that's a guy who could pay some dividends for you with probably a last round flyer. I mean, I can't see people picking him at all.
No, and I think he's interesting because his swing is actually kind of set up nicely for Fenway. If you look at it, switch hitter, if you're batting from the right side, I think he could do some damage there. He's always been a guy who his power totals were a little depressed by playing out in San Francisco and some of those ballparks in the National League West. So I'd like to see what he could do. And given the current context of power in the major leagues and how much it's risen and you know whether or not that's due to a change in baseball or not, you know, that's for someone else to say. We don't have all the facts. But you know, he could provide some pop, and I think third base is down a little bit as a position as opposed to shortstop and second base. So those are good names. Are you surprised at how much power Andrew Benintendi has considering his size? Because if you look at him, he's not a very big human being. He's literally like 5'6 or 5'7, it looks like. I mean, he's not very big at all, but man, can he hit the ball hard. It doesn't make a lot of sense. I don't remember guys who have that sort of physical stature who can hit for that kind of pop. It's very rare.
Yeah, I mean, the only other one I can think of plays opposite him in the field in Mookie Betts, really.
Right.
Two very similar guys in that they're both
Altuve
small but
too.
have a lot of pop. Yeah, Altuve too. He's in that conversation. But yeah, Benintendi, I mean, since his second year at Arkansas, he pretty much flipped a switch and was able to hit for power. And he seems to be able to have mastered the art of controlled violence with his swing. I mean, he seems to be able to barrel everything, but still swing with enough effort that someone his size can actually hit the ball with that type of authority. So I think it's a pretty unique thing that he has going there. But he's been doing it for a while now. The sample size is very big. So I think that this power isn't really going anywhere. I think it's a trademark of him. And it's going to be cool to watch. It's anytime you get somebody that makes that much contact and that much hard contact from someone that size, it's just interesting to watch. And really, I think you could throw Pedroia early in his career in that same category too. He doesn't have quite the pop that he used to, but Red Sox are big on getting these Mighty Mouse type players that seem to be able to wallop the ball despite their size.
Hey, good work, Ben Sherrington. You got that draft pick right. He got a lot of things right. So that's my take on things. My motto is going to be this season: let everybody overpay for Trey Turner. I'll take Andrew Benintendi instead. That's fine with me.
Yeah, I agree.
Let me give you one more interesting name: Joe Kelly. Do you think he could do something interesting out of the bullpen if they're going to use him for multiple innings? Or, you know, he was good. I mean, you look at the last month or two, his numbers were off the charts. Do you think there's anything there?
I do.
Not as a starter, obviously.
You know, Joe Kelly really has great stuff. I don't know if you've heard this before at Baseball Prospectus, but yeah, he does have great stuff.
Damn it.
But he did start using his great stuff in a different way last year. He started to work up in the zone a little bit more. And I think when we saw that happen, we saw a lot more improvement from him. So I am optimistic that he can keep that going. But at the same time, I mean, we've seen flashes from him so many times and then seeing that go away. I do believe that this change that we saw late last year is more real than other flashes that we've seen in the past, and he's certainly someone who could be a multi-inning weapon. I don't think that's out of the question at all to see him come in for two and possibly even three innings at some point during the season. Although I think they'll primarily use him as a seventh inning guy. It wouldn't surprise me at all to see him regularly used as sixth and seventh type of guy.
Yeah, I don't think he's someone you're drafting even in like an AL only, but I definitely put him on my watch list early on in the year. I think that the strikeout totals could be something that helps you out. And given the general landscape of terrible starting pitchers, once you get outside the elite tiers, that's something to consider. someone to watch. So
the ratios will be good anyway. I don't think he's in any danger to close any games.
Yeah. All right. So let's run through here. The other fun thing, because we back in our younger days, we used to do a podcast together in which we would talk mostly prospects. So one of our annual traditions, and we've done this the last couple of years, is we like to compare our top 25 dynasty prospect lists. So we have both taken the time here. We didn't spend hours doing this, but mine took like 10 minutes. Just put some names down on a page, and we're gonna go. We're gonna go through ours together. Mine are sort of tiered because there are. I'll give you kind of the general rundown. I feel pretty good about the top 7 or 8.
Yeah.
There's a next tier down that goes to about 20 that I feel pretty good about. Then I have my 5 people I'm higher than the rest of the world on from 20 to 25. And then there were like 10 guys who almost made the list that like I felt bad about excluding. But, for example, Jorge Mateo, speed is speed, but, didn't have a great year. Got himself suspended. Gleyber Torres showed up. Like, I don't know. I have a hard time. I'll never be the highest in the room on him, for example. So I just kind of put him towards the bottom and off my list. There are a couple guys like that. But let's run down the top 5 for both of us because I feel like they're going to be similar. So why don't you give me yours and then I'll counter.
Can I still count Benintendi as a prospect or is he not going to count for this?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we did this where you have to have prospect eligibility. So for example, there's no like Trey Turners or Gary Sanchez types or anything like that. So the two interesting names who are current major leaguers that still kind of have prospect eligibility, I guess Alex Reyes counts too, but Andrew Benintendi and Dansby Swanson are both still prospect eligible by like an at bat each, so they count. So okay. Go ahead.
I will go Benintendi 1. Eloy Jimenez 2, Yoan Moncada 3, Victor Robles 4, and Dansby Swanson 5.
I never thought I'd hear someone else in the world who had Victor Robles higher than I did, but I've just heard it. This is amazing. I feel like I need to stop the show right now. That was incredible. Good work, number one. Boy, Robles is interesting. We'll get to him. I didn't have him in my top 5.
Okay.
Which is interesting. But once again, like I said, my top 7 or 8, I feel really confident about. They're Eloy Jimenez and Victor Robles are my 6 and 7.
Okay.
So I have them right there too. The thing for me about Jimenez is there's still he's a massive human being. He showed prodigious power. I mean, just go look at the crazy exit velocity numbers he put up in the AFL with the Statcast data they got from him. It's nuts. It's like Stanton-esque. So I think Jimenez is special, but he's still a long ways off. I think the margin for error is just high enough that I wouldn't be confident putting him over guys who are right there.
Mm-hmm. I could see him hitting for 35 home runs someday, though. Easy.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing is what's the power landscape going to look like in 5 years or 3 years? Because Chris Carter hit 41 home runs with a terrible batting average, albeit, but like he wasn't worth very much at all. So that's the context in which we're operating, and I don't think there's any speed with Jimenez. So, yeah, if he's going to hit 40 bombs a year, he's going to be insanely valuable, but there's a lot of factors that'll impact his value. And for Robles, similar issue. I don't know how much power actually shows up. That's the one part of his profile that's interesting. He's, a 5-tool guy, but it's all projection right now. Obviously, he's hinted at the power coming, but we haven't seen it consistently. So I had him at 7. I love him at 4. That's extremely aggressive. I love it. I love it. I love it so much.
I'm going for the high ceiling guys, George.
Great work. So my top 5, I had Yoan Moncada number 1, just because the power speed combo alone. If that all comes together, even the downside is, switch hitter batting in the heart of the lineup who's going to hit. If at his apex, he could be a 280 guy with 20 plus home runs a year and 30 plus steals easily.
Those guys, I was going to say 30-30 even. He's got that potential.
Yeah, I don't. The power is interesting. I don't know what, you know, whether. Yeah, I could see 30. He's so good. It's really kind of scary. And the speed is the thing for me, though. It's some guys just have the ability to steal bases, and he's one of them. He's a really good athlete. So I had Andrew Benintendi at 2, Dansby Swanson at 3, very established. Alex Reyes at 4, because he still counts for this list. Then I had Brendan Rodgers at 5, just because shortstop, Colorado, he's already hitting for power. This could be fun. So Brendan Rodgers to me is right there. So give me your next 5 or so names. Take us out to the top 10 here.
Well, I'm going to go with Gleyber Torres as my number 6. I'm going to go Brendan Rodgers, number 7.
Okay.
Alex Reyes, number 8. Mm-hmm. Lucas Giolito, number 9.
Oh.
And I am going to close out my top 10 with little J.P. Crawford action.
Okay, so we have a very similar rest of the top 10. I had Giolito at number 9 exactly, too. I don't quite know where to rank him at this point if we're talking in a dynasty. Because the ceiling is everything comes together. The command improves. The velocity ticks back up. And he's a frontline ace-level starter. The downside is the control is never there. And he's like a middling rotation guy who can probably strike people out, but it's going to get shelled pretty routinely.
Yeah.
I can't think of a good comp, like Robbie Ray-ish. Like, it could be like one of those profiles that's like, oh, okay, I don't know.
Not out of the question for a Robbie Ray type profile, especially playing in Chicago now. But they tend to get the most out of their guys.
Yeah,
you know, Don Cooper is he's a magician.
Yeah, I have confidence in him. That's why he's still in my top 10. But there are legitimate question marks with Giolito, and that's something I don't think we were saying a year or 2 years ago. You had Torres in your top 10. I have him at 18 just because, well, I'm not confident that he's the all-around fantasy force that we think he's going to be. I think he's still a really good player, but I don't know. From the sense I've gotten with talking with people for Baseball Prospectus and some other sites, nobody I know has put him in their top 10. Now, he was impressive in the AFL. Absolutely could be there in a year, but you know, I don't know.
Maybe what are the pitfalls that you would caution with a guy like Gleyber Torres right now?
Well, what's the power ceiling realistically? I mean, what really is it? He hasn't hit for a ton of power,
right?
So, if you look at shortstop right now, it's at the highest level it's ever been at. So mm-hmm. He's gonna have to hit for substantial power. I think defensively he's gonna stick there, no doubt. And I think he's really good. I don't have. We're you know, splitting hairs here when we're talking about the difference between, you know, 8 and 18, but I just think there's more risk in Torres because of the offensive profile than I think people want to acknowledge. So the only guy who I have in my top 10 that you do not is Manny Margot. And the reason for this is he's going to play every day. Everybody laughs. They go on Twitter and they go, ah, the Padres depth chart, it really sucks. And sure, it sucks. But you know what that means? Margot's going to get 600-something plate appearances, and he's going to steal 30 bases. He's a lock for 30 steals. You know how valuable that is? Only like 11 guys stole 30 bases last year. And
what do you
all
think
of them turned a profit. He's insanely valuable in fantasy right now, and I don't think people are realizing it, and nobody's investing in him. It's
what do you think about Margot's hit tool? Do you think that he's going to be able to maintain a decent batting average this season?
Sure. I mean, what – it's – in the grand scheme of things, the steals are what's going to be carrying his value, right? In theory,
right.
You're not paying him expecting a 280 average. If he hits 260, he's not going to kill you.
Right.
Outfield was not great last year. I mean, look at, like, for example, you know, I was just looking today at Adam Eaton because of all the White Sox stuff. And last year he was let's see, if I can find it, where did I write it? He was 18th in our evaluations at Baseball Prospectus. He was the 18th best outfielder. And last year he hit 14 home runs and stole 14 bases with a 284 average. Yeah, how much – if Margot steals 30 bases and hits maybe, I don't know, 8 to 10 home runs and hits 260, is he worse than Adam Eaton? from an evaluation standpoint. I mean, it's crazy to think this, but like the volume is going to be there because no one is taking his playing time away unless he really craters or something crazy. Right?
Right.
Is that
nuts? I agree that he's going to play. He's going to play every day, and he's going to accumulate numbers that way. But I don't know if like 8 to 10 home runs is a realistic thing for him. I could look at him this year in that ballpark with that lineup and see like 4 to 5 home runs.
I'm aggressive on him because I think it pays to be aggressive on a guy like this, because there's a really good chance for profit. Obviously, everybody in your league thinks, you know, Alex Reyes or Dansby Swanson are good. So you're not going to have a buying opportunity there. I think I think the conventional leagues, just your average league, I don't think they've come around on a guy like that yet and recognize the value of speed yet. So I like him a lot. So
you know, I've always been the low man on speed, George.
Well, the profiles suck, but like we go through the valuations every year, and every year all the speed guys turn a profit. So
yeah.
It's not the worst investment in the world. Sure. Like, even Billy Hamilton, he has this, like, I like to call it, he has an image problem. People think he sucks, and he does suck. He sucks at hitting, but it does not matter. He still returns more than what you pay for him in a draft.
Yeah, he stole approximately 600 bases last year, right?
58, but he had I think it was an 88% success rate or something on that, and he missed like 60 games. You know,
it's ridiculous.
It's pretty nuts.
I want to get back to Gleyber Torres real quick here. Sure. So I want to make a point about shortstops playing in Yankee Stadium. The current shortstop of the Yankees, Didi Gregorius, his previous high for home runs in a single season in the minor leagues was 7. And last year he hit 20 bombs in Yankee Stadium. So I think that the prospect of a guy like Gleyber Torres with a swing that's clearly more power oriented than a guy like Didi Gregorius in that park, and even if he hits like a 75% approximation of what we think he could be from a power standpoint, that could be a really dangerous thing there.
Yeah, maybe I'm being too cautious because I don't want to be the guy who overreacts to the AFL where everybody can hit for power and says, oh my gosh, this guy's a top 5 or 10 guy. I didn't want to be that reactionary, but maybe it is justified. I split the difference would be my advice. I think he's right on the cusp of being a top 10 guy, no doubt.
Yeah,
absolutely. It could be a totally different story in a year. He could be in the top 5 of this list. So who are your next couple of guys that, you know, the 10 to 15 range on your list? And then we'll kind of breeze through the rest of these guys.
I've got Rafael Devers, Clint Frazier. I have, where am I? Okay. Willie Adames.
He good.
Franklin Barreto. And who else do I have?
Very similar.
I have
list to me.
Ronald Acuna.
Okay, Acuna was one of my my 5 for 5, as I like to call them, guys who I am high on compared to maybe industry or general fantasy consensus. I hit him all the way at 23, and that's just because of the proximity of the majors is crazy far. He's literally like what, 19 right now?
Yeah,
he played in A-ball, so
I don't know if he can drive yet.
And good question. I think he's actually in Australia right now playing Winter League, which I guess is Summer League there. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me.
The toilet flushes the other way too, doesn't it?
Yeah, you haven't said Tyler Glass now yet. Did you just not put him on at all because of the in the majors factor?
Yeah, what? I wasn't sure if he was still eligible, so I wasn't sure about him.
Technically, he still is, so I had him on my list at 11. I had Josh Bell here in my top 15 too, just because, you know, first base actually is not that great, and Josh Bell, watching him a couple of times, he's weird. Don't get me wrong, I don't understand what to make of him, but there is talent there. So
I want nothing to do with Josh Bell. I'm going to give us our first disagreement here. I think Josh Bell is just not going to be a worthwhile play in fantasy. I think that he'll probably get some runs scored for a first baseman. The average will be decent, but I think by and large, he's going to give you Very little in the RBI and power department. And when you're drafting a first baseman, I mean, that's what you need, right?
I agree. It's first base only profile, and that really kills him. Do I like the idea of Josh Bell, or do I actually like Josh Bell? I watched him a few times, and yeah, I thought going in, I was like, oh, there's no way this guy impresses me. And he has moments where I don't understand what's going on, and then he'll crush one down the line for a two-run double. And you're like, okay, that was weird, but that's kind of Josh Bell to me, and I don't want to write a guy like that off. I had Raimel Tapia in my top 15.
Mm-hmm. He was right on the cusp for me. I really like Raimel Tapia. I got a chance to watch him in person last year, and I just came away so impressed by the ability that he has to barrel up just everything, everything that he sees.
Two reasons to like him. One, he does the two-strike crouch. He wasn't terrible in center field. They put him in center field in AAA. Tapia is weird because the profile is so unorthodox that this is the kind of guy you either like immediately or you will not touch in a decade or two of playing fantasy baseball. He's such an odd ball. I don't know how else to describe him to people, but he could win a batting title, and it's not a fluke. I've called his bat-to-ball extraterrestrial because he might not be from this earth. It's freakish. It's crazy.
He's really skinny, too. Watching him, it's unbelievable how small he is. And I don't know. He looks like a cartoon character holding an oversized bat.
Oh, my God.
It's so funny.
I won't go that far on him. I love Raimel Tapia. He could steal some bases, too. Like, this is a scary thing. Like, if the speed comes together and he just starts smacking doubles and cores, like, this could be a really fun player. If he finds a way to the top of the Rockies lineup, boy.
Yeah, he could score 100 runs easy.
God, Tapia is so much fun. Just imagine the possibilities. Willy Adames in my top 15. And then you've already mentioned a lot of the guys I had in the rest of my top 20. Barreto, who had a really good second half last year. That's underrated. Clint Frazier, I have questions about his contact rate. He swings and misses a lot. He strikes out a ton. But when he hits the ball, man, it goes. He's freakishly talented. So I don't have too many questions about the talent. I worry about, is he going to make enough contact that he's the superstar we all want him to be?
That's a legit worry.
It's something to monitor. He could easily correct it, or he could go the other way, and you end up with a guy with a ton of swing and miss. I worry about that. Austin Meadows made my top 20. He has some legitimate injury concerns, but nobody, I think, who I've ever talked to about him questions how good he is. So we'll see. Who are your last five guys and some names that you like overall?
I have Ozzie Albies in there because I think that there's not a lot of guys playing that position that are going to be fantasy relevant. I have Nick Gordon, who had a really good fall, and I still believe in his profile. I have our old friend AJ Reed in there still. I still believe with that. I'm sticking by him. I know that he had a really bad year,
the Astros aren't,
but I'm still buying some AJ Reed there.
good luck.
And then Vlad Guerrero Jr. I'm going with Vlad's boy. I really like what I see from him.
It's like when I want to put Bo Bichette in my list just so I can say Bo Bichette five times real fast. Bo Bichette, Bo Bichette. Okay, my five. Dan Vogelbach. he's going to be so much fun. You don't even know how much you like Dan Vogelbach. Brent Honeywell. Yes.
Of course.
I think with the AFL performance, he's right there. And another guy who really shined to the AFL, Ian Happ for the Cubs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's great.
Ronald Acuna. Now is the time, people. Do not wait on this guy. If you wait a year, you'll be shut out. Same goes for Isan Diaz. Mauricio Rubio, who I've had on this show a couple times now, he loves the guy. I think Diaz has a restraining order out against him. fun fact. And my last guy, like, I had three or four guys that I was considering here. Ahmed Rosario is obviously like the safest play. Cody Bellinger is that random first base prospect who can actually be someone who matters. Josh Hader by DRA is crazy numbers. But I went with a reliever here. I went with Joe Jimenez. There. Anybody else you want to talk about? I put Jimenez on. I could have put Rafael Devers, Aaron Judge, guys like that. And you know, I just want to talk about Jimenez because he's interesting.
I think I had a couple guys on my cusp that I didn't get to mention that I'll throw out there. I still really like Francisco Mejia. I think it was really interesting what he was able to do with that hit streak that he had last year. And I know that, you know, catchers aren't all that valuable, but I think that's worth mentioning. And then Francis Martes, I really like still.
He had a pretty good AFL.
Jake,
hey, thanks so much. This was an intelligent conversation. I think we were rational about prospects, and we covered a lot of good Red Sox stuff. So appreciate you coming on. This was fun.
Yeah, anytime. Pleasure, and thank you for having me. And, hope that we see some more interesting prospect stuff, and I get to chat some fantasy again with you, my friend.
Sounds good. And you're welcome back anytime. And by the way, where can everybody find your stuff? Tell us about the podcast and then your Twitter and where we can find your work.
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at @DevJake. You can view my articles at Baseball Prospectus Boston. And also the podcast, The Red Seat, is up on there as well as iTunes and Stitcher. So we record weekly about the Red Sox. So if you're a Red Sox fan, it's a must check out podcast for you guys.
If you're ever going to have the official Robbie Scott podcast, you can invite me on and I'll talk about his different deliveries to righties and lefties, different arm angles and such.
Well, I really like Robbie Scott, so I'm going to have to take you up on that.
Yes, he's so fun. Jake, thanks so much. We'll do this again soon.
All right. Thanks, George.